For 20 years, Small Business Digest has helped millions of entrepreneurs grow their business. We do this by highlighting ways they can increase profits. Whether these suggestions improve marketing and provide better financial management, offer robust people management ideas, provide speedier logistics, our guests each offer ways of reducing costs, adding sales, widening profits. I'm Don Mazzella. The program is Small Business Digest, and we have a wonderful guest, someone we've been trying to get on for a long time, Craig Dowden. He's got a wonderful new book and some really great ideas. Craig, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for the invitation. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, first, tell us a little bit about your background, and then a little bit about your book and your company, and finally your website.
Well, I have a PhD in psychology and a specialization in business, so I do a lot of executive coaching work, so one-on-one with senior executives as well as executive teams, and then I also do a lot of leadership development training workshops, both with aspiring leaders as well as middle managers and then senior executives all around the science and practice of positive leadership. And my first book, Do Good to Lead Well, The Science and Practice of Positive Leadership, was just published by Forbes a little while ago, and thrilled to say it's an Amazon bestseller, which is great. So the response has been fabulous, and it really provides a roadmap. So I review 6 pillars of positive leadership, and within each chapter, I essentially define the pillar, then talk about the evidence or the research behind why it's important, so what bottom line and intangible impacts are achieved by following the principles within the pillar. And then at the end, the bulk of the chapter is each chapter is spent on, so how do we translate that pillar into practice? So essentially, it's evidence-based leadership practice. So this is that's basically who I am and what I'm about. And my website is www.craigdowden.com.
Can you spell it out for our radio audience?
Sure. It's CraigDowden, as in Nancy, .com.
Well, you've got these pillars, so let's start there. And could you just briefly outline them and then pick, since we have limited time, pick one and just explain it?
Sure. So the 6 pillars are self-awareness, civility, humility, focusing on the positive, meaning and purpose, and empathy. And so just to give you, I would say that empathy, we can start there, certainly do a deeper dive on empathy. And so essentially empathy is the ability to take the perspective of someone else. So how aware are we of someone else's reality? Can we walk a mile in his or her shoes? And there's a lot of powerful research showing how empathy is an invaluable skill and ability in terms of both currently as well as in the future. So top organizations like Google, Adobe, and others are really highlighting that empathy is the future. LinkedIn, I believe, had a survey a little while ago, and their results was that empathy is one of the most mission-critical skills for business and business leaders. And there are a lot of different ways that, and before I get there, another study, which is very powerful by the Management Research Group out of the Northeastern U.S., and they have a 360-degree feedback tool where you get assessed by your direct reports, your peers, and your supervisors. And they found out of the 22 leadership competencies that they assess, empathy was the third highest predictor of executive excellence. And this was a sample of over 250,000 leaders and managers. So empathy was the third strongest predictor of executive excellence out of the 22. And it was the strongest predictor of ethical leadership out of the 22 competencies, which I think is particularly powerful, especially in today's environment with a focus on corporate social responsibility and following organizations that uphold the highest ethical standards. So I think that research and evidence is quite powerful. And then one surefire way, an evidence-informed strategy to use to demonstrate empathy is to ask lots of questions and be curious. And so they are open-ended questions. So anytime we have an opportunity to interact with someone, I will say to people and organizations I work with, it's important to act like a conversational Sherlock Holmes. Your job is to gather as much evidence as you can and as much data as you can about a particular individual. And what it does is paint a very compelling, rich portrait about their life, about their experiences, about who they are and what they're trying to achieve. And the important piece around empathy is not to judge that information. It's to really just sit with it and understand it and use it as a base, as a foundation from which to interact with that other individual.
Well, I'm an older guy, and I've been through a lot of different organizations. I hear what you say, but I guess my first question to you is, all the great leaders I've seen lead from the front and say and demonstrate an uncanny ability to identify the problem and find the solution. And the best of them find a solution with other people. But people like Steve Jobs, they just came up with the idea. That's my feeling. But what are your feelings? How does a person obtain this empathy and demonstrate it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, and for sure, to be able to provide, and you're touching on such an important point around providing vision for where the organization is going to go, be ambitious in terms of what that looks like, that mission for the future, if you will. And I think the empathy component is gathering information from various data sources. And I think that's what's really key. I've had the privilege to interview well over 50, 60 CEOs of international organizations. And the conversations that I have with them, they'll say, what's at the heart of failed business ideas is when I get so enamored with my own perspective on things is that I lose sight, I tune out all of the data and the information and feedback from other valued members. So that's people within the organization, so further down the organizational hierarchy, as well as customers and stakeholders. And that I almost kind of put my own needs and my own stamp and perspective on a situation as the only relevant data point. So it's essential to have that information both to make a more informed decision for me as well as so that I can identify potential landmines. And I think that's where what's important is just because we access the reality, the perspective, the opinions of other people doesn't necessarily mean that we have to change things. So I think that's a really important point you're raising as well. Empathy doesn't mean that just because you look at something differently than me that I necessarily have to change my approach or my solution. By being empathetic and trying to understand the situation from your perspective, the benefit of that, though, is that now I understand when I'm interacting with you what potential hot points, you know, trigger points that I may step on during our exchange, and then also how I can better position my message so you'll be open to hearing it. And what's really fascinating is within the conflict literature, so there's lots of conflict that can happen, one of the primary things that enable and prolong conflict is when the other person doesn't feel heard. So even if you're right, they fight against you because they don't appreciate, they don't feel like you're interested in listening to their perspective. So being empathetic, even if you go in a different direction, kind of greases the wheels of influence. So I think that's where it adds a lot of value.
I'm laughing. I have to tell you, I sight read. And as a manager, somebody would bring me in a memo and I'd look at it and I said, well, let's talk about it. And I'm failing to realize that that person had labored 2 or 3 days over it. And there I was within 30 seconds saying, let's talk about it. And they always felt as if they were never really heard. It took me a long time to really. I had read it and processed it. It just, I did it differently. Something very difficult I had to learn. Your suggestion hits home, but I'll throw a real I'll throw a real curve at you. You know, having worked with Donald Trump and knowing how he works, you know, everybody complains about him. And I don't know if you read The Art of the Deal, which I've read twice, only to understand the man. He's a man who appears as if he doesn't hear what you're saying if you're a subordinate, but acts on it later on. And that's his modus operandi. He will never admit that he's heard you, but will do what you say eventually. And yet he's become the president of the United States. I mean, I know it's a loaded question. Would you care to comment on the management style? Forget everything else.
Well, I think a couple of things in every domain, and this is what's interesting. This is why, for me, I think, you know, when you look at the data and the evidence, there's always outliers. So people who can, you know, operate in a particular way, and they are, quote unquote, successful in the different areas in which they're involved. So I think, you know, when you look at the evidence across what is positive practice, I focus on kind of what happens through the mainstream. In terms of Trump's management and leadership approach, I think that's where for and many commentators on both sides have highlighted this, is that, you know, that sometimes lack of empathy or demonstrated empathy can create some challenges. Where that there's a, if there was a subtle tweak to the approach that was taken, rather than how much could he, you know, did he accomplish, it's almost how much more could he accomplish and how much more quickly could we get there and could he get there with that opening up of an interest in other perspectives. So I think it's a really compelling and interesting question around, so with that lack of empathy, it can create a very strong reaction within other people. And so then what might happen if those doors were opened a little more fully, shall we say?
it's an interesting point. Our program is about small business, and in smaller businesses, the leader has an outside impact, more so than even on a more immediate one than in a bigger. Would you care to kind of switch the gears a little bit and talk about what a person within a smaller organization, what are some of the things that they should be looking for to be better managers?
Oh, well, I think one of the key things here, and empathy is equally valuable in a small business perspective. There's actually, I mean, one of the more powerful pieces of research to me is that they've actually found that websites that are rated as higher as in empathy actually drive higher levels of digital sales, which I think makes a whole lot of sense in terms of when that perspective is being embraced. Secondarily, from an empathy in small business leadership, that can assist the business owner in terms of gathering input and data from their team, the people who report to him or her, and so that unlocks their input. By being more empathetic, individuals feel understood, cared for, so they're much more inclined to want to go above and beyond. So the research is also clear on that. When we feel understood and when the leaders or leader of our organization has our best interest at heart, we're more likely to engage in what's called organizational citizenship behavior. So I'm going to go above and beyond my role to be able to support this business to be successful, and I want to be here long term. And then I would say from a, you know, customer service and stakeholder management standpoint, by being empathetic, asking lots of questions to the people and organizations we serve, it also reinforces that message outside of our small business, which is, wow, this is great. You know, Don really cares about me and what we're about, and so he's going above and beyond. It's not about just about the product or service he's offering. He wants to understand my reality, how he can better serve me, how his organization can better serve me, which then drives and elevates trust, which then wants me to want to continue and potentially deepen our relationship. So regardless of the size of business, there are so many applications, I feel, around how empathy can drive benefits for us and really change the context of the conversation. Because the other fascinating thing is that evidence shows that empathy is on the decline. Despite how important it is for business success, the research is showing that our empathy levels are lowering almost every single year. So it's a huge potential competitive advantage.
Oh, that's very interesting what you just said, because in my mind, I was saying, based on my experience, that the idea of empathy seems to be waning. People are not as interested in other people as they were when I was a lot younger.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, some of the ideas, theories around this, you know, the move to technology, social media and things like that, which tend to be relationship inhibitors. And once again, going back to the study I referenced earlier, websites that are rated higher in empathy drive higher levels of sales, which once again, to me, what's really fascinating is regardless of where in the world we live, one of the primary, if not the primary human needs, is to be understood, that you get me. And if I feel like you get me, and I think, you referenced Steve Jobs earlier, that's one of the pieces around Apple products. I mean, one of the rallying cries for people who own Apple and why they're such fervent supporters, they'll say, I get this technology. The technology gets me. It's so user-friendly, and the interface is wonderful because I don't have to try to figure things out. It feels very natural. So this, once again, drives trust and level of engagement. So once we feel understood, that is an invaluable currency for us. So once again, this is where reaching out, being empathetic, stimulating conversation, having conversation, becomes very powerful because now we're building trust, which is so essential.
Well, you know, I'm sitting here a little flabbergasted because you said something. We've had other people with similar things, and it's the first time I've heard about the empathy level coming down, and I'm just trying to digest it because it's been a fear of mine because I just see three people walking down the street, all of them having earbuds, you know? They're walking together. And I'm sitting there saying, or you're in New York City, one of the great cities in the world, and you have earbuds on, and you're not looking at the people around you. It scares me.
Absolutely.
How can we break this cycle? What are some suggestions you make?
Well, I think one that I touched on earlier is to ask questions. So be curious is one of those really easy things that we can do. Be curious about other people and be non-judgmental. Doesn't matter what affiliation they have or their philosophies. Engage in conversation and be curious. Ask lots of questions with the goal to understand. And an important caveat to that means just because I understand you doesn't mean I have to agree with you, yet what it does is empower me with information. And again, the more information I am, the better quality decisions I can make. Another one is to meet face-to-face.
Can I interrupt you there? Because I've been a reporter for over 50 years, and I've been asking questions of people at the very heights of their lives and the very depths of their lives for a long time. But what I'm seeing today is that when I ask questions, the same way I've been doing it for 50 years, the people are not willing to respond. I'm seeing that more and more. I taught a class at Columbia for high school seniors for their scholastic last week on interviewing. And I was just amazed at how these kids were so reluctant to answer questions. And I just stood there at the end of the class, which I've been doing for 12 years. I turned to somebody and said, the world has changed. Whether it's good or bad, I'm not going to say, but the world has changed. And please, you're the guest.
No, I was going to say that. I was going to say, building on your point, is that because we're almost, we're becoming out of practice in conversation. So then it becomes really challenging to provide an answer to a question if we're not used to having a conversation. One of the big challenges with technology, email, text, et cetera, is that, well, what it does is enable me to control the conversation and enable me to control my answer. So to come up with something spontaneously can be quite a challenge and quite uncomfortable. And so I'm really out of practice. I'm not having the opportunity to build those muscles to think in the moment when I'm communicating. The second piece, I think, as well, and it doesn't sound like it would operate in the classroom, yet more broadly, I think, what happens, people have seen the impacts when there's almost a pile on social media if something comes out. So people are very careful about, well, what are you going to say because of the social media backlash? And people say things online that they would never say to you face-to-face or in an elevator. So it just kind of, there can be a reluctance to step in and provide an answer. So I think it's that combination. And I would assert more of the former, which is we're not getting much experience in how to have a conversation. You talked about it earlier. People are walking down the street all with their headphones on, or at dinner, and you look at friends at dinner and everybody is on their cell phones posting the meal to Instagram rather than sharing the experience. And looking at it from a happiness research perspective, in fact, what you find is that happiness comes from social interaction and sharing experiences together, not posting them.
I wish I could record it and play it back to people, what you just said, because you're so on target. We have just a few minutes left. Can you, will you repeat your pillars for our audience and your book? We're talking with Dr. Craig Dowden. Your book again, Craig, and how people can get it?
So my book is Do Good to Lead Well, The Science and Practice of Positive Leadership, and it's on Amazon.com, Amazon.ca as well, for any Canadian listeners. And my website is CRAIGDOWDEN as in Nancy.com, CraigDowden.com. The six pillars of my book are self-awareness, civility, humility, focusing on the positive, creating a sense of meaning and purpose, and empathy. And so happy to follow up with anyone about their interest in these pillars, because they're essential to our success personally and professionally.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. But can you take one more and just briefly give us a little bit more about that, since we have a few minutes and I don't want to waste any of it?
Oh, no, for sure. So I can share another pillar, which is self-awareness. So that's a nice complement to the empathy side. And so self-awareness essentially is the degree to which I know who I am and how I come across to other people. And so one of the real challenges, so what's interesting is that there was a study done of over 500,000 people, and they wanted to see what was the predictor of success, both personally and professionally. And a lot of times people think, oh, well, there are certain personalities that are better suited to be quote unquote successful. And through their analysis of 14 different personality profiles, neither of them were predictive of success. So every personality profile was equally predictive. What's really interesting, though, the number one predictor, without question, was the level of self-awareness. And what's really interesting on top of that, though, is only 30% of us are reasonably self-aware. And we all know people who think they are people. And yet when we talk to the people around them, they'll say, well, the only time I'm happy is when, Craig leaves the room rather than when he comes into the room. So there are big obstacles for us.
Can I interrupt you?
Yeah, sure.
Would you define self-aware?
Yes, so self-awareness.
What do you mean by self-aware?
Great...
I'm sorry. I'm curious.
No. Yeah, so self-awareness is the extent to which I recognize who I am. So who am I and how I come across to other people? So the degree to which I'm aware of who I am and how I come across to other people. So there's a big component of me understanding who I am at my core, and then there's an equally important part around, am I aware of how other people perceive me and how closely those two images align? Because using the example of the people person, a lot of people think they're a people person, yet when you talk to the people around them, that image is not shared widely, if at all. And so that's a major obstacle to us being successful, because when I'm interacting with you, I think I'm great from a people standpoint, and you're experiencing me in the exact opposite way, which of course then leads to a strong disconnect in terms of our ability to form a personal or professional relationship.
I have never met a person who thought they were a great people person who was.
yeah, exactly. Well, and that's a great link to the humility chapter, which is, and this is fascinating. You'll likely appreciate this. What the evidence shows is the more confident you are in your ability in any domain, chances are you are the least competent when it comes to actually exhibiting that.
Amen to that one. I couldn't agree with that one more.
Yeah, exactly.
Yesterday was my birthday, my 76.
Oh, happy birthday.
thank you. But the point I wanted to make on it is that the person I am is definitely not the person I thought I was. So,
and I think we're all on that journey for sure. And I think that's an important journey to be on, is be open to that, the lessons that come with that.
I always start my classes with young people saying, I'd gladly change places with you to start all over again, but I know it'd make the same mistakes. But Craig, one more time, I hate to cut this one off, but one more time, your book and how people can reach you.
Not a problem. So the book is Do Good to Lead Well, The Science and Practice of Positive Leadership, and it's available on Amazon, and my website, CraigDowden.com.
Mm-hmm. I wish we had more time. You have to come back and talk some more. Thank you so much for being
You're
with
welcome.
Us today.
You're welcome. This was a lot of fun. Happy to do it again in the future.
Look forward to it. And have a great day.
Take care. Thank you. You too.
One. The Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions. I grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone, and my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. For family, long a center of his life was unraveling. Recall, his mother, Tony Soprano's mother, actually ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of their shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with a mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore. The show is Small Business Digest. Your host is Don Mazzella. We have an extraordinary guest today, Christopher Johnson. He's with Pitney Bowes, and we welcome him to the program. Christopher, good morning.
Well, good afternoon, and thank you, and good morning, and thank you very much for having me on the show, Don. I appreciate you having me on today.
Well, Christopher, before we start, as we do with most of our guests, tell us a little bit about yourself personally and your background, then a little bit about Pitney Bowes, which I discovered this week. Everybody knows the name, but really doesn't oftentimes know all that you do, and I just learned something else as well, which we'll get into, and then finally a website. So the floor is yours.
Great. Well, thanks, Don, again. And let me just start off first with a little bit about myself. So I've been a member here of our team at Pitney Bowes for the last 3 years. I currently stand as the president of our financial services division at Pitney Bowes. Prior to arriving at Pitney Bowes, I spent a good amount of time in doing small and middle market financing in a variety of different firms. I spent probably the most of my professional background with the General Electric Company and GE Capital, but also worked at a number of sound financial firms prior to that. The best thing about my background is that I've had the opportunity to work with middle market and small business firms in a variety of fashions here in the United States, as well as in Europe, as well as Asia Pacific. And what's remarkable about that experience is that no matter where you are around the world, many of the same concerns resonate. And the matters that are most important to small businesses tend to be consistent. So it's a pleasure here to be a part of Pitney Bowes, to lead a great organization that's focused on small and middle market financing, and to be a part of how we're reshaping our company and transforming it around our focus in the small business market. From a business perspective, Pitney Bowes, I'll just give you a quick overview, Don, and then I'll allow you to ask some more questions there. But Pitney Bowes has been helping small and mid-sized businesses for nearly 100 years, helping them take the complexity out of conducting commerce. Worked on a number of growth markets as we look at our business, inclusive of shipping, e-commerce, as well as financing. We are a company that is dedicated on helping small and middle market clients on main streets all across the U.S. Grow and succeed in their businesses. In the business I run, financial services, we help them to acquire the critical assets that they need to grow and expand their businesses. And we have spent the better part of about 40 years running a financial services organization, and within that, a banking organization as well for about 30 years now.
Well, that's the part that floored me. I hadn't realized for 40 years that you had a financial component of Pitney Bowes. But before we go further, a website where people can go to learn your division.
Yeah, so I would welcome folks to go to www.wheelerfinancial.com. That's W-H-E-E-L-E-R financial.com. And you can always scroll down there to the Contact Us button and click on that, and someone will be willing to reach out and discuss how we can help and partner with you more. And, of course, our corporate corporate website is www.pitneybowes.com.
Well, let's talk about Wheeler for a moment. And you have an arrangement with them that's new to me, at least. So tell us about that first, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, and if I can actually back up just a little bit, Don, I'll tell you a little bit about the legacy of our financial division. And then what I want to do is then I'll go to your question on Wheeler, because I think they go hand in hand. So if you think about the last 40 years, Pitney Bowes has been a core part of mailing, shipping, sending, and more increasingly the commerce market, inclusive of some of the areas that we support around e-commerce as well as shipping logistics and fulfillment. When you think about all of those types of business models, what's core to them is that it requires cash and cash flow as well as technology and services in order to conduct any of those operations. So we started about 40 years ago partnering with small and middle market businesses here in the U.S. and then increasingly around the world, helping those companies to acquire the goods that we would manufacture and sell to our customers. What we then evolved into about 10 years later, so it's about in the late 90s, we actually acquired and created the capability to have a banking banking function as a part of our business. That actually is the Pitney Bowes Bank. It's a member FDIC, located in Salt Lake City, Utah. And as a part of this institution, we do some working capital lending, helping our clients to acquire their working capital needs, such as, you know, postage or any of the supplies or consumables that they would need to operate in these types of commerce businesses. And so we have been serving this part of the market, which is a critical and essential part of our U.S. economy, for a very long period of time. It is this basis, Don, it's this background that we have that allows us to launch our newest offering set to small and mid-sized companies, which is Wheeler Financial from Pitney Bowes. And that business is really all about and is dedicated to helping small and middle market clients, as we talked about before, acquire other critical use assets that are essential to their business and their business operations to help them grow. And we're just really excited and pleased about the focus that we have and how we're able to partner with companies straight across the U.S. on main streets, up and down, to help them really be successful as they work to expand their businesses.
I'll get back to that in a moment. We're talking with Christopher Johnson. He's president of Pitney Bowes Financial, and he's here to talk about what I think is a critical expansion, I think, for Pitney Bowes, if I heard you right, you're saying, in effect, if a company needs a new printing press, you're in the business of helping them get the financing for it. Am I hearing you right?
Yes, you are right. And let me give you some examples. So we, through our portfolio, have a lot of experience with clients in helping them to acquire these types of essential assets that are necessary to run their businesses. In our portfolio, we've got a lot of experience in areas such as healthcare, business services, in areas like manufacturing and industrial, construction, et cetera. And so if you take, for an example, a small physician's office, or if you take a manufacturing and industrial company that is looking to expand or to upgrade the equipment that they have inside of their operations, we're the folks who have been partnering with companies just like yours for a long period of time, and we understand your needs. And so what we're looking to do is to help these types of companies acquire, for instance, an X-ray machine, or you might need networking gear and servers, or you might need a printing press in order to continue your operations. And that's where we want to partner with our customers. We know our portfolio. We know our customers and small and mid-sized businesses are performing well. We know that they have had a fairly good run of expansion here that's buoyed our economy. But ultimately, we also know that it is hard for these small businesses and middle market businesses to obtain the critical financing that they need to invest in their businesses. So if it's hard for them to get the capital that they need to expand, then ultimately they won't be able to achieve their goals, and that's where we come in. We have the ability, we have the financing capabilities in order to support those businesses, and we look forward to partnering with companies that we have been a central part of for the last part of 30 or 40 years and helping them to grow.
You said a very good word, hard. Small business tell us after healthcare, the hardest part of their job is finding the financing to grow and expand, and in some cases even maintain. But what is your average time between application and decision for a small business?
So I think in terms of Wheeler Financial, we just launched our new offering a few weeks back. So we will, I am sure, we'll be able to talk about that in the future with more depth. But if you look at what we've been doing for a long period of time, it really depends on the size of the transaction. So smaller transactions have been able to be turned around very quickly. And some of the larger transactions may require a few more days. But what you're talking about, Don, is a very important point, which is can companies, financial services firms, be responsive to the needs of small businesses? The reality is most companies are not. Most financial institutions are not able to be responsive. They're built to serve really larger institutions. We, on the other hand, given the portfolio that we have, 750,000 customers here in the United States, it gives us access to the type of proprietary information as well as the kind of access to the knowledge, right, that you need to be able to understand small business and be responsive to them in the way that everyone would expect to be.
I agree. We've had an onslaught here on this program of people from what is now called the fintech industry talking about 24-hour and turnaround, et cetera, because it was interesting. In our surveys, we find that most small business realize they need the money yesterday rather than a month from now. For them, they've been stymied by banks, and large banks are even allying with the fintech institutions to attack this market. and I applaud Pitney Bowes for going into it. But I guess my question, and we're talking with Christopher Johnson, he's president of Pitney Bowes Financial, is why Wheeler Financial? And why? What are they offering to you that you couldn't do on your own?
Well, listen, I think it's a great question, Don. And let's start with some of the real statistics about what's really happening in the market from a perspective of small and middle market companies and their difficulties and their challenges in getting access to the capital that they need. So if you step back and look at the market, here's what's startling about the why we are so focused and we believe that this is an important part of our next steps as a company. If you look at the United States, and we'll just take a horizon of the last 10 years, in the last 10 years today, you would see that loans to corporations are at the highest levels that we've ever seen since we've recorded records here in the United States. Yet still, at the same time as we see those types of statistics, when you look at actual dollars, the loans to the small and middle market companies, so small business loans in the United States, here's the truth, Don. They have declined every single year, year after year, for the last 10 years in a row. So ultimately, what we have is a dichotomy happening in the market. Large corporates, larger companies have an easier time of operating. The smaller companies, it's getting harder to operate. But they're still very sound, and they're great institutions. So when we looked at the opportunity, we saw that we had a great level of insights into these companies, because that's who we serve, that's who we've been focused on. This isn't a perspective of simply just a technology play. I think having the right technology is important to make it easier and efficient for companies and customers to procure the loans that they need. However, you need to have the right depth of expertise in order to have the staying power and the focus in this particular market. So as we've looked at this, the time is now and the time is right for us to focus in this area, because small businesses need this type of capital. They represent a significant chunk of our economy, Don. This is over 50% of the jobs. This is over, 75% of the jobs here in the U.S., or 50% of our economy in the U.S. Without this sector working, the U.S. is not as strong as we would want it to be.
Could not agree with you more. We've been shouting that message for the last 10 years based on our surveys, which always indicate that finding the financing has always been the most difficult part of growth for many small companies. And we define small, by the way, as under 500 employees. I don't know how you define it.
I think it'd be similar. So we would look at it as, you know, companies that are, you know, from a few million dollars of revenue up to, you know, middle market size, you know, let's call it $100-$150 million is kind of where we would play. But we have a large portion of our market is going to be in that smaller enterprise, less than 500 type of employees with, you know, anywhere from a few million dollars on up.
Okay, well, let's now move on. Why have you partnered with Wheeler?
So Wheeler Financial is our company. We actually, it's a wholly owned subsidiary of Pitney Bowes. What we did is we partnered with Genpact. We partnered with the Genpact organization. Very important for us in order to help in the technology and the servicing component of our new offering. What we wanted to do was to have a platform that we thought was highly efficient, easy to use for our customers. And we wanted to build a scalable infrastructure that our customers would be able to have from a relationship standpoint in the future going forward. So let me spend a little bit more time in this area, Don. So you mentioned fintechs earlier, and I think fintechs, certainly everyone has heard about what their role and what they're trying to accomplish. Unfortunately, what we haven't seen is the amount of dollars flowing into this segment of the market fundamentally change since fintech started to talk about entering this particular area. When you think about why, it's really that combination of having to have efficiency and technology, but also having the domain expertise as well as the access to capital to win in this space. What we bring to the table from a Pitney Bowes perspective through Wheeler, right, is this access to four decades of experience doing financial transactions with SMBs. We bring almost 100 years of domain expertise in commerce around small and middle market companies. And we also bring a significant amount of capital to the table in the concept of having a bank, owning that bank, and having access to a good amount of capital deposits in that bank that we can deploy in something that we know how to do very well in terms of equipment financing. What Genpact has brought is this technology, an agile infrastructure, as well as a flexible technology that allows us to scale very rapidly and serve our customers in a very innovative way. You put the two things together, and through that, what we've done is we've created the best of what we think are really two worlds in the sense of great technology, modern, scalable, with the horsepower and the knowledge in the domain that really understands how to serve small businesses in the small equipment finance arena. So that's what our partnership is founded on, and Wheeler Financial from Pitney Bowes is a wholly owned subsidiary that provides that offering to our customers.
Well, it's interesting because in our focus groups, one of the reasons people don't go to a fintech company is because they don't know them. For all intents and purposes, Wheeler is something new. Why not use the Pitney Bowes name on the product?
Yeah, so what's really so a couple of things there that I want to just point out. So Wheeler Financial from Pitney Bowes, through this, what we are doing is serving, you know, the same customer base that Pitney Bowes has served and what we've been focused on. Our average relationship inside of our financial, my financing business is between 8 and 10 years of age. And I would agree and concur with something that you also said, Don, which I think is very important, which is customers, companies, especially small and lower middle market companies, they prefer doing business with somebody who they have a relationship with, number one, and also they want to ensure that that relationship, they generally speaking like to work with somebody who's smaller in nature and that has the ability to have the staying power to be with them for a long period of time. Those things make logical sense. And so when you think about what we're doing here, Pitney Bowes been serving these customers for a very long period of time, domain expertise and knowledge in this particular industry, dealing specifically with small and lower middle market companies, and putting together the power of Genpact with their technology capability to provide Wheeler Financial. Now, why did we name it Wheeler Financial? Well, the truth is we named it after someone who is inspirational in our business. Walter Wheeler is a visionary that worked for Pitney Bowes. He actually served Pitney Bowes for over four decades as a salesman, as a European representative, as well as a general manager. He was the CEO of Pitney Bowes from 1938 to 1960, and then served as our chairman for 13 years. He was truly a visionary in commerce, someone who had the impact on the commerce business that we understand today, as well as someone who inspired us and our team members across Pitney Bowes. So when we thought about our branding and about what we would do in terms of bringing out this new product capability and this offering to our customers, we were very proud of Walter Wheeler, his commitment to doing things the right way, and to his philosophy around working with clients. And so we were honored by naming our newest offering after him, Walter Wheeler and Wheeler Financial from Pitney Bowes.
Hmm. Boy, I could go on and on, Christopher, but unfortunately we're running out of time. We're talking with Christopher Johnson. He's president of Pitney Bowes Financial. We got about a minute left, Chris. What would you like to impart to our audience?
So I would leave you with this, Don. Wheeler Financial is really built on our heritage. If you are a small or middle market company looking to grow, seeking alternatives, and understanding how to build the right types of strategic relationships that are going to help to propel you going forward, well, Wheeler Financial from Pitney Bowes is the kind of company for you. We are built on your experience. We are focused on your success, and we welcome you to go to www.wheelerfinancial@pitneybowes.com, and that's wheelerfinancial.com. Scroll down to contact us, and we'd love to connect with you. Thank you very much,
Johnson,
for having me on.
Well, Christopher, thank you for coming, explaining a lot to us. It's been very informative, and we thank you. And a link to you, to Wheeler, will be on our website tonight when the show comes up. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
One, Tony Soprano, the famed fictional crime boss who grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark, New Jersey, turned to a psychologist to resolve some of his conflicted emotions. I grew up in the Ironbound section of Newark at the same time as depicted in the forthcoming movie prequel to the television Soprano saga. In the highly successful television series, Tony Soprano was a man born to the mob, yet questioning his birthright, the rules he lived by, and the people he associated with. Tony Soprano was not alone. And my book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, talks about those changes and the people they affected, myself included, and the fictional Tony Soprano. The period 1950 to 1965 was the time of major changes, hitting Tony Soprano in fiction and my neighbors in real life. He, like many of my neighbors, felt the strain of an evolving Italian-American heritage. Tony Soprano and my generation were being torn from their roots, rendered from the comfort of their familiar with changing rules and mores. The family, long a center of his life, was unraveling. Recall, his mother, actually, Tony Soprano's mother, actually ordered his liquidation. The mob to which Tony Soprano was born to was morphing in ways he neither understood nor wanted. My book, Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, explores these changes by leading the reader through the labyrinth of channels swept away for most of us of Tony Soprano's generation. Tony Soprano is fiction. His experiences were not. Return with me to those times where individuals did things differently there and needed to adapt to changes without comprehending the exact nature of those demands. Certainly, Tony Soprano did not quite understand. Neither did I, nor others of our generation. I provide insight in Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, because my father was for many years the chief launderer of the shirts and the pressing. My mother had a lifetime friendship with the mob boss, and I covered them for the Newark News. The book is Frankie, If You Get Hurt, I'll Kill You, and available soon here and at your favorite bookstore. You have been listening to Small Business Digest. Our website is the number 2 SB Digest. Go there to hear this and all past and future shows. And tell us of the guests you would like to hear on this program. Remember, this show is about helping our audience improve profit. I'm Don Mazzella, and thank you.